to the News Magazine on the America Out Loud Network. I'm Alana Friedman, and this is The Friedman Report. Welcome to the News Magazine on the America Out Loud Network. I'm Alana Friedman, and this is The Friedman Report. Well, the big news of the week was the president saying that he's pulling the troops out of northern Syria so that the Turkish troops can come over the border and create a 20-mile safe zone for refugees from the Syrian war. Now, the problem of all this is that there are already people there. He wants to put in 20 million refugees. But there are already people there, and these people are the Kurds. And the Kurds are bitter enemies of the Turks. So the concern is that when the Turks come in, they are going to slaughter the Kurds. And the Turks have a much bigger and much fiercer army, although the Kurds are very fierce fighters. They can't hold a candle to the Turkish army, which is better equipped and much greater in number. But in order to tell the story properly so that you understand it, I need to start at the beginning to tell you a couple of stories that lead up to what the president has done this week, and that will help you understand why what happened, what the president did, is so concerning. It started with some kids. They'd just gotten out of school, and they decided that they wanted to do something adventurous. So they wrote some graffiti on the side of a building, and they ran away. Now, the problem is this didn't happen in the United States, where when a kid writes some graffiti on a wall, he may get punished. He may get his allowance taken away. He may not get to watch television for a week. He may even have to clean the wall. But it doesn't go much further than that. The problem is this didn't happen in America. This happened in Syria. And the graffiti was all about the government. And it wasn't flattering. So the police came by. They found the kids. And they took them to the police headquarters. Well, word got around that the children were being abused, even tortured. And a demonstration started forming outside the police station. And then throughout the town. And then into other towns. And then throughout Syria. And the people demonstrated against the Syrian government because of the brutality of the way that they treated the people of Syria. And that was the beginning of the Syrian civil war in 2011. But there has been nothing civil about this war. It has been brutal. It has been cruel beyond understanding. And hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians have been murdered in this war. The latest numbers available indicate that over 500,000 people have died in this war. As the chaos continued, as the demonstrations against the government continued to grow, the government came down hard on them. It bombed them, it arrested them, it tortured them, it killed them. They'd killed men, women, and children alike. And so one of the things that began to happen is that this war became very interesting to terrorist groups from outside the country. And they started coming in and taking advantage of the chaos. They came, set up camps, and began to create their own kind of chaos. One of these groups was started by a man who was handpicked by Osama bin Laden. His name was Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. And he started an al-Qaeda-linked terrorist group called the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. The original organization was an al-Qaeda organization. But little by little, this organization broke away from al-Qaeda and became what we now call ISIS. And when it moved into Syria, it started hiding under the cover of other small terrorist groups. But it developed its own signature. So, for example, when it wanted to carry out a mass killing, it would line up the people, mostly men in this case, next to a ditch and line them up and shoot them and let them fall into the ditch, and then they left them there. And the same thing was true with women and children, except they usually put them in a room and then killed them in the room and left them there. And this became a kind of signature for them. Later on, when they became better organized, one of the first things they did to gain notoriety, which they were looking for, was to take a dozen Coptic Christians, put them in orange prison suits, take them to the edge of the Mediterranean Sea, and line them up, and then slit their throats, and let their blood bleed into the sea. These were not nice people, and they became less nice as time went on. Eventually, their leader, a man by the name of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, declared himself not just the leader of ISIS, but the caliph of the Islamic State. And he began to organize in a way that probably has not been seen in a terrorist organization, but was certainly seen in Nazi Germany. He kept very good records. He appointed people around him who could do as he told them to do, and then made sure that everything was accounted for. But he did things that really we hadn't seen before in such an organized fashion. They had slave markets, because according to their view of Islam, it is okay to take slaves from people you conquer who are not Muslims. And so they had slaves as young as 10 years old, and they were sex slaves. And they were raped frequently, not only by the men that owned them, but by other men as well. So some of these little girls would be raped many times a day. These men were worse than animals. And whenever ISIS came into a new place, a new city or a town or a village, they would impose harsh Sharia law. They would tax the population, and they would make it very clear who was now in charge. For example, one young child, about 10 years old, forgot to go to or didn't go to Friday services. And he was made an example of and executed in the public square, a child of 10 years old. And he was not alone. This happened with some frequency. And they would desecrate the churches and the holy places and sell the antiquities on the black market. This was ISIS. So al-Baghdadi decided to name the Syrian city of Raqqa as their operational headquarters, essentially the capital of the caliphate. And from there, he ordered the operations of ISIS. Now, ISIS then moved into Iraq, stole from museums, stole from the farmers. They demanded their crops. They demanded their produce. They demanded their livestock. Anything that they could acquire, they demanded. And then they demanded taxes from everybody who lived under their authority. They went into Christian towns in Iraq, defiled the churches, stripped the churches, made the people who lived in these ancient Christian towns, made them leave with the clothes they had on their backs. And then they raided their homes. So this is the way ISIS functioned in Iraq and in Syria. And from their headquarters in Raqqa, they threatened terrorist attacks against the rest of the world. Until Donald Trump said, enough. By the time Donald Trump said enough, ISIS had already been fairly driven out of Iraq, but not out of Syria. And they were still creating havoc in the northern parts of Syria. Donald Trump declared that America would send a limited number of troops, and together with the Kurdish fighters from the north, the American troops would finally conquer and get rid of ISIS in Syria. And so they did. The Kurds are a people without a country who live along the border areas of several countries, including Syria, Iraq, Iran, and so forth. And they are an amazing people. They are courageous, they are fierce fighters, and they are loyal. They've had their very, very difficult days because between ISIS and the Turks and the Iranians, who don't want them in their countries, but the Kurds made good partners with the Americans. And they fought ISIS, and they essentially drove ISIS out of Syria. So Donald Trump said this week that enough is enough. We've had it. We're going to end this war. We've done what we said we were going to do. We've accomplished our goals, and now it's time to get out. And this was at the same time that Turkey was putting pressure on America to get our forces out because Turkey wanted to come in and set up a 20-mile buffer zone in northern Syria where they could put people who had been displaced by the Syrian civil war, up to 20 million of them, in what they would call a safe zone. But that means, according to the Turks themselves, that the Kurds, whom they consider to be terrorists and their enemies, would have to leave. And one way or another, they would make sure that they did. So now we have President Trump saying American troops are going to leave. They are not going to be there to support the Kurds when the Turks come in. And there is a great fear that the Kurds will be massacred by the Turks. Now, these have been our fellow fighters. They fought and died together with American soldiers. And so the question is, did Donald Trump do the right thing by agreeing to leave northern Syria, where they had been fighting with the Kurds, and leave the Kurds to their own devices? I've written an article, which you can see on the America Out Loud website, and it gives you more details about the history of the Kurds and what they have been through, and how they have been betrayed and deceived. It may help you to make a decision on your own as to whether the president did the right thing. But that's not all. And what I recommend is that you visit the homepage of America Out Loud and see the other articles on this subject, because there is a whole page full of very good articles by very smart people. And they don't all agree with me. So you will get many opinions there about the president's decision. And I urge you to go and take a look at it and read it, and then make your mind up with all the new information you have about what you think about the president's decision. Now, here's another controversial question that came up on Tuesday when the State Department refused to allow Ambassador Gordon Sondland to testify in the House impeachment inquiry. This raised a terrible ruckus in Congress because it was the first salvo against the Democrats' unceasing attacks against his presidency that has culminated in what they call an impeachment inquiry. The president has said, and we've mentioned this before, and we'll probably mention it again, the president has said that as long as the House does not comply with custom to require a full vote of Congress in order to initiate an impeachment inquiry, the president will not agree to allow his cabinet members to testify before the committee, despite the fact that they have received subpoenas. Now, you can argue this any number of ways, but the fact is that the custom of Congress has always been to have a vote before an impeachment inquiry is undertaken. But the Intelligence Committee and Congress in general has just gone charging ahead without a vote. And I will discuss this a little bit later. But for the moment, just to tell you that the latest news is that the first subpoena has been rejected by Ambassador Sondland. And we now need to see what's going to happen next. The White House generated a letter that was obtained by the news media. The document said this: "The President Trump and his administration reject your baseless, unconstitutional efforts to overturn the democratic process. Your unprecedented actions have left the president with no choice In order to fulfill his duties to the American people, the Constitution, the executive branch, and all future occupants of the office of the presidency, President Trump and his administration cannot participate in your partisan and unconstitutional inquiry under these circumstances. The president has a country to lead. The American people elected him to do this job, and he remains focused on fulfilling his promise to the American people. The president has made it clear that since there has not been a formal vote in the House to open an impeachment inquiry, and the news conference that Nancy Pelosi held last month wasn't sufficient to allow these proceedings to commence. The letter went on to say, quote, "In the history of our nation, the House of Representatives has never attempted to launch an impeachment inquiry against the president without a majority of the House taking political accountability for that decision by voting to authorize such a dramatic constitutional step." Without waiting to see what was actually said on the call, a press conference was held announcing an impeachment inquiry based on falsehood and misinformation about the call. They're talking, of course, about the call between President Trump and President Zelensky of Ukraine. Now, the phone call led up to the whistleblower, which led up to the question about who was the leaker. I have a lot more to say about this, and I will later in the show. But in the meantime, we now have to wait and see what's going to happen next. This is like a soap opera. And as with any good soap opera, we are going to be left hanging until the next installment of the story begins again. But as the sides are drawn, it's getting really interesting because the president, finally, is starting to fight back. So, while we're waiting to figure this out, we're going to take a short break. We have a lot more to talk about. Some of it's funny. Some of it may be a big surprise. So stay right there, and we'll look forward to seeing you back here in a few minutes.
The question I always get asked is, where do I get the energy from? Well, keeping up with Malcolm Out Loud is no easy task, friends, even for Malcolm. Well, you may know that I've personally been taking Healthy Cell for some time now. Well, the great news is Healthy Cell has a new type of natural supplement called the Nutrition Gel. So no more hard-to-swallow pills. The good taste in gel can be mixed into smoothies, yogurt, or water. These gels provide maximum absorption of essential nutrients, and it's healthy for our gut, not abrasive like pills can be. You know, it's time for all of us to go pill-free. And you can try it with a free 2-day supply. Just cover $2.95 shipping, and the company, Healthy Cell, will cover the cost of the product. Go to healthycell.com/outloud or simply click the Healthy Cell logo at the top of AmericaOutloud.com.
You know what is happening in Washington these days? It just gets worse and worse with every passing week. And yes, Congress is taking another recess. Didn't they just take one? 6 weeks in July and August? But maybe it's a good thing if it means that they'll stop their bickering and give regular Americans a few moments of peace. Not likely, though. They'll just carry on from their districts as they start gearing up for next year's election. Just for laughs, do you know how much they earn while they're not doing their jobs in Washington? The compensation for most senators and representatives is $174,000, and that includes even the brand new freshmen. I'd like a job like that. And with all that vacation time? Well, to be fair, this is the time, that vacation time, that's when they're supposed to be available to their constituents in their home districts, responding to their issues, the ones they're supposed to be legislating for in Washington. Okay, so $174,000 is the base salary. The only exceptions include Speaker of the House, that's Nancy Pelosi, who gets a salary of $223,500. Which seems a shame considering how little work she does, and the President Pro Tem of the Senate, and the majority and minority leaders in the House and the Senate, who each get a salary of $193,400. Then they get almost $1 million each for their office personnel, And then they get official office expenses and they get, you know, the franked mail and so forth. Now, what they're supposed to be doing when they're earning all this money is to be legislating, putting together and voting for and passing, hopefully some of them, laws that will help to improve the lives of their constituents. That's their job. But what they're really doing right now, and I'm really talking about most of the Democrats here, is spending all their time and resources on doing whatever is necessary to bring down the sitting president of the United States. And that's the real job that they're attending to when they're ignoring the work they are supposed to be doing. And then you have the screwballs. Not only are they not doing their job, but they are really destroying the process of congressional legislative business. Take Rashida Tlaib, for example, who is Michigan's freshman congresswoman and a member of the infamous squad. Now, she wants members of President Donald Trump's administrations, the ones who have been served subpoenas and who are refusing to comply with them, she wants them to be arrested. And now she's wondering about who will be the ones to carry out the arrest, if it should come to that, as if that's what really matters in all this. So what is this all about? It's a bit confusing, but let's sort it out. Well, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has challenged the president by calling for a formal impeachment investigation into allegations that he acted improperly in talks with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. But she's done this without calling for a formal vote of the entire House membership. And the president says that if the Congress does not take a vote on whether or not to hold an impeachment inquiry, he will order his people not to honor the subpoenas. And he's done that. Now, he maintains that if Congress does not vote on it, the inquiry isn't legitimate, and he has a point. Pelosi simply skipped the vote. In a letter to House Minority Kevin McCarthy, she explained to him, quote, "The existing rules of the House provide House committees with full authority to conduct investigations for all matters under their jurisdiction, including impeachment investigations." And she added, "There is no requirement under the Constitution, under House rules, or House precedent that the whole House should vote before proceeding with an impeachment inquiry." But she's wrong about that. I don't know if she simply doesn't know it, if she didn't take the trouble to look it up, or if she's lying. But the precedent is clear. There have been 3 impeachments of presidents in the history of the United States. Andrew Johnson was the first, and there was a vote of Congress prior to the impeachment hearings. Then there were presidents Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton. And the full House authorized both inquiries with a vote. But Pelosi is making her position very clear. She says there's no requirement that there be a floor vote. She probably has the vote she needs. The magic number is 218. But she just doesn't want to do it. And the question is, why? Well, here's one possibility. Pelosi has invited the 6 committees who are probing Trump's conduct to continue their investigations and make their best case, if any, for drawing up potential articles of impeachment. Now, if Congress does not take a vote on this, a formal vote, then the Democrats can choose not to allow the Republican members of the committee to question the witnesses who appear. Now, if she does authorize a vote, if the vote is not successful, if she loses the vote, which is to say, if she doesn't get a majority that agrees on pursuing the impeachment inquiry, then she's dead in the water. The subject is dropped. If she does win the vote, then the impeachment inquiry goes forward. And I think what Nancy Pelosi really wants to do is to extend this process as long as possible and bring it up as close to the election as possible, and then maybe take a vote, maybe a full vote on impeachment. Now, it's still quite clear that the Senate will not agree to impeachment, But if the House does, then that might very well influence the vote in favor of the Democrat candidate. And I think that's what she wants. And then, according to the Republicans, a formal vote would give them the authority to call their own witnesses and request subpoenas, and maybe she doesn't want that. You know, it's funny, just one of the first 36 presidents, Andrew Johnson, was impeached. He was impeached by the House and then acquitted in the Senate by just one vote. And that could happen here, too, except that in the Senate, I think President Trump will get a lot more than a majority of one. Back in July, the House of Representatives voted 230 to 198 to hold Attorney General Bill Barr and Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross in contempt of Congress for defying congressional subpoenas. Now, that's what the president is suggesting that his cabinet members do, defying the subpoenas. While it is only the second time in history that a sitting cabinet member was held in criminal contempt, it was not unprecedented. Do you remember former President Barack Obama's Attorney General, Eric Holder, was held in contempt after he refused to turn over documents relating to the Operation Fast and Furious gun running scandal? Attorney General Eric Holder became the first sitting member of a cabinet to be held in contempt of Congress. The president says that in order for these subpoenas to be honored, the Congress has to take a full vote of the House of Representatives. Okay, we've talked about this, and I don't want to go into it again, but one of the loudest voices in the House of Representatives, one of the shrillest voices, is the voice of Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House. And I want to talk about her a little bit because she's becoming the center of attention in a very unfavorable way. Her behavior is getting to be so egregious that it's starting to elicit reaction from her fellow congressmen. And here's an example. Congressman Ralph Abraham has introduced a resolution in Congress to expel Nancy Pelosi from the House. Did you get that? A Louisiana Republican congressman, Ralph Abraham, has introduced a resolution to expel Speaker Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat from California, from the House of Representatives. If this isn't a sign of Republican frustration, I can't even begin to imagine what would be. It may be true that his resolution stands no chance of passing in the Democrat-controlled House of Representatives. At the same time, this is a very, very strong statement. In fact, he made some remarks that I'd like to read to you. Quote, "Nancy Pelosi's vicious crusade against our lawfully elected president is nothing more than a politically motivated witch hunt, and it must be stopped. She has disgraced the People's House and weaponized the Speaker's gavel for her party's gain. House Democrats spent nearly 3 years obsessed with election meddling, only to dwarf any such efforts with their own deceitful plan to nullify the 2016 election and prevent President Trump from winning in 2020. I have introduced a resolution calling for her to be expelled from the House and for the Speaker's office to be vacated," unquote. There is little chance that this is going to pass. And in fact, the resolution hasn't even attracted many Republican co-sponsors. But still, it's a statement, and it's a very strong statement, and the Democrats would be wise to listen. You know, something very interesting is happening here. And it's happening rather suddenly. For a long time, the Republicans have watched all this going on without being very reactive. Some of them have spoken out, but mostly it's been quiet. Even the president, although he tweets a lot, he hasn't taken very strong positions in terms of his daily activities. But all of a sudden, what we're seeing are the Republicans getting backbone in and standing up and starting to assert themselves, something they should have done a long time ago, against the Democrats. And the president is doing the same. And I, for one, am very glad to see it, because I think this is long overdue. The Democrats have been riding roughshod over Congress, over the Democratic process, over their Republican counterparts, and enough is enough. It is time for the Republicans to stand up and fight the good fight against the Democrats, who are essentially destroying this country. And that's pretty much where the discussion stands at the moment. We'll see what happens next, but it's going to be very interesting for sure. Now, there's another part of this story that I still want to talk about. The Democrats have reached a level of hysteria that is beginning to look a lot like panic. Everything that's going on in Congress is becoming a real circus. The Democrats are hell-bent for leather to get this president, to get him out of office, to get him out of the White House. And it's absurd. They're going to such ridiculous lengths, and they are so hysterical about it. If it weren't so sad, it would be funny. They've been looking for an excuse, any excuse, to impeach the president. They've tried one thing after another. It's like they're throwing mud at the wall until something sticks. They started off spying on the Trump campaign, and they tried that to see if they could get a hook into some kind of angle that would make Trump look guilty. It didn't work. So then they commissioned a made-up story that was contained in what was called the Steele dossier, and it was paid for by the DNC and the Hillary Clinton campaign. This was a totally made-up story. It was fabricated from beginning to end. But it did serve a purpose, and that was that it allowed the Justice Department to use it to justify a request for a FISA warrant that allowed them to spy on the Trump campaign. And then, as a result of that, the Mueller Commission was set up to examine exactly what happened and whether or not there was collusion on the part of the Trump campaign with the Russians. Now, isn't it interesting that the people who actually colluded with the Russians were the Democrats? But they were accusing the president of that. Okay, so then Mueller gave him his report 3 years and $35 million later, and it found that there was no evidence of collusion on the part of either the president or his staff. So once again, the Democrats failed to find anything to pin on President Trump that could bring him down, which is what they wanted to do in the first place. And they began to consider impeachment, even though there was no crime to impeach him for. And then came the phone call, this famous phone call between President Trump and Ukrainian President Zelensky. An unidentified whistleblower sent an anonymous document, a complaint, to the head of the Congressional Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, in which he complained with secondhand knowledge about the telephone call that had taken place between the two presidents. And that was enough for Adam Schiff to start the ball rolling on an impeachment inquiry. And here we get to where we started this story. But now our story has a new wrinkle, and I will share it with you in the next segment of this program. The person who was the whistleblower was promised that his identity would be shielded from the public. Why should that be? The president is entitled to face his accuser. We've talked about that. And yet, the head of the Intelligence Committee has promised to shield the identity of this person. Only now we know who it is. And that creates a whole new situation, because now we can ask questions. We can say, where did you get this information? Because we still don't know who the leaker was. Who was the one in the White House who leaked this information to the whistleblower? So we'll have more about that in a little bit. Now here's some food for thought. In the beginning, when this country was brand new, our congressmen and senators were called citizen legislators because they went to Congress, they went to the Senate, they served their terms, maybe they served two terms, but when they were finished, they went home. And they went back to their old professions. If they were farmers, they went back to farming. If they were lawyers or teachers, they went back to those professions. And other people took their place. That doesn't happen anymore. When someone goes to Congress, for many, it's a lifetime job. And that's wrong. It's something we need to change because there is too much old blood in Congress, too many old brains, and we need new people, we need new ideas, we need people who have read the Constitution, who understand it, and who believe in it. I'm actually a believer in term limits. I think term limits would solve many of the problems that are now plaguing our Congress. But that's a discussion for another day. And on that note, I will leave you for a short break, but don't go away. What's coming up is our new segment called You Just Can't Make This Stuff Up. And in addition to that, because we have a secret we're about to unfold in the next segment. So stay tuned. I'll be right back.
Spreading the out loud truth from sea to shining sea. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world. To unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. We are the vision of the voices. Welcome to the new era in communications. America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Lieutenant Randy Sutton, the host of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I am a 34-year police veteran. I am also the founder and CEO of an organization that stands behind injured and disabled law enforcement officers. It is called The Wounded Blue. Our website is thewoundedblue.org. We have produced a film. It is an important film. I urge you to watch it. The film details what happens when a police officer or law enforcement officer is shot or stabbed or beaten or disabled, seriously injured in the line of duty. Most people think they are taken care of medically and financially. The reality may be quite different. It is called The Wounded Blue, Service, Sacrifice, Betrayed. The film is available on Amazon, iTunes, and the Microsoft Store.
Okay, well, here's where we get to the section called You Just Can't Make This Stuff Up. And here we go. Here's a doozy, I'll tell you. I didn't believe this when I heard it, but I'll share it with you because I think it's actually hysterical. So here's the deal. New York City has a commission on human rights that recently released a new legal enforcement guideline that bans the use of the term, quote, illegal alien, unquote, by employers, housing providers, including hotels, and law enforcement. They say, these commissioners, that the term illegal alien is discriminatory. And violators can be punished with fines that are as punitive as they are exorbitant, up to, are you ready for this? $250,000 per offense. In other words, the city will now penalize anyone for using what is actually the correct legal term for an undocumented person. This term has been used both in federal immigration courts and in numerous court decisions, including the Supreme Court. What did they mean when they wrote the First Amendment? You can't make this stuff up. And then we have 16-year-old Greta Thunberg. She came to the United States in order to speak to us Americans and tell us how wrong we are in what we're doing to this world. She went to Iowa. She went to Iowa City, Iowa, where she gave a speech. 16-year-old Greta Thunberg. She said, you can't make this stuff up, folks. You just can't. She said, this is all wrong. I shouldn't be up here. I should be back in school on the other side of the ocean, unquote. Well, she got that part right anyway. She should be back in school, back in Sweden. So let's give her credit where it's due. But let's go on, because she had a lot more to say. Quote, yet you all come to us young people for hope. How dare you? You have stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words, and yet I'm one of the lucky ones. People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you? Unquote. As if that weren't enough. She wasn't finished. Actually, she gave a speech, you know, so she had more to say. Quote, how dare you pretend that this can be sold with just business as usual and some technical solutions with today's emission levels, that remaining CO2 budgets will be entirely gone within less than 8.5 years. There will not be any solutions or plans presented in line with these figures here today, because these numbers are too uncomfortable and you still are not mature enough to tell it like it is. You are failing us, but the young people are starting to understand your betrayal. The eyes of all future generations are upon you, and if you choose to fail us, I say we will never forgive you. We will not let you get away with this. Right here, right now, is where we draw the line. The world is waking up, and change is coming, whether you like it or not. Unquote. Wow, what a mouthful. So here's this 16-year-old telling her audience that they are not mature enough to understand the importance of what she is saying. Wow, that's chutzpah. Honestly, okay. You know, it's interesting, because when you look at the figures for the world of carbon emission, it is true that the United States is the second largest emitter of carbon in the world. But here's the thing. The first is China. And China represents 27.2% of global emissions, while the United States represents only 14.6%, and the rest of the world is doing the rest. It's really quite amazing how hysterical the climate change people are when they blame America for polluting and insist that America has got to take care of the rest of the world in terms of reversing climate change. It's ridiculous. America produces 14.6% of the world's carbon emissions. And yet we're supposed to clean up the rest of the world? That makes no sense. China produces over a quarter of the carbon emissions. And yet nobody's talking to China. And you know who's third, by the way? Third is India. That's less than 10%, so I don't think we have to worry about India. It's the rest of the world that makes up the other, let's say, 60% of the pollution. So when a little girl like Thunberg comes and tells me, how dare you tell me you are failing us? No, I'm not. I'm not. I think you're failing me. Because you're trying to tell me, who has a few more years of experience, and probably much more education than you do. Don't lecture me. Don't lecture me. Don't tell me what I should do, how I should be living my life, when you haven't even begun to live yours. Go to school. You're right. That's where you should be. You should be at home and going to school instead of coming here and lecturing me. How dare you? But I'll tell you this, Greta Thunberg. How about this? I'm happy to have a conversation with you. I'm happy to talk to you about climate change. Don't lecture me. Come sit with me with an open mind and let's discuss what's really going on in the world. You don't have the scientific background to really understand, and neither do I. But there are certain things that we can observe, that you have observed, that I have observed. Yes, there are things going on with our climate, but we don't know why. And that's the problem. And if you don't know why, it's going to be difficult to fix it. And there's another thing, something I mentioned before. If you don't understand why something is happening, and you only want to take a small corner of the world and demand that that corner fixes it for all the world, then there's something wrong with your understanding of the problem. And that's what I'd like to talk to you about. Let's both get more understanding by sharing, by talking, by having civil conversation. Not I dare you, not how dare you, but what do you think? Why do you think this is happening? What do you think? Why do you think this is happening? Let's talk. Now, there's another story I want to share with you. It turns out that President Trump has a rally, one of his big famous rallies, scheduled for Minneapolis later this week. And the mayor of Minneapolis, Mayor Jacob Frey, has presented the Trump campaign with a bill for security. Okay, this is pretty normal when you have an event and the local police provides security. The city presents you with a bill. That's fair. But this bill is actually quite amazing because the bill that he has been presented for security for his rally is more than $500,000. The rally is scheduled to be held at the Target Center in Minneapolis on Thursday, October 10th. Now, the Target Center holds 20,000 people. That's its capacity. Now, the interesting thing is that Minnesota is a blue state. Traditionally, it's a blue state. And we would expect that Trump may not have a very large following here. And yet, as of this broadcast, the Trump campaign has already received nearly 75,000 requests from people who want to attend. That is fairly standard for Trump rallies. But in Minnesota, which is a traditionally blue state, and where the freshman senator, Ilhan Omar, is so vehemently anti-Trump, this is nothing short of amazing. The head of the police union says that Minneapolis's liberal mayor, Frey, is trying to bully the president out of Minnesota. The president tweeted, quote, "Someone please tell the radical left mayor of Minneapolis that he can't price out free speech. It's probably illegal. I stand strongly and proudly with the great police officers and law enforcement of Minneapolis and the great state of Minnesota. See you Thursday night." Now, if you take a look at this bill, $530,000 for security for an event, and compare it to other events that have taken place, similar events, you'll see how outrageous it really is. Last October, for example, the president held an event in Rochester, Minnesota, And the charges for security were $76,138. And of that, the campaign paid $26,215. And they held the rally at the Mayo Civic Center. When President Barack Obama held a rally at the Target Center in 2009, which was 10 years ago, admittedly, we would expect it to have cost less, police estimated that the costs amounted to something in the neighborhood of $20,000. Now, compare $20,000 10 years ago with $500,000 in 2019. It would appear to be clearly punitive against Donald Trump. The police are supporting Trump. Now, in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, police are not allowed to show up at political events in uniform. So in response to that, the police union has created a red Cops for Trump t-shirt for the officers and for anyone else who wants to wear one. And they're selling online for $20. Now, this t-shirt, as I said, is red. It shows a map of Minnesota with the stars and stripes covering the entire state, and the message, Cops for Trump. As the head of the police union said, in compliance with policy, he said, we don't want any issue. So we just thought, you know, that we'll turn the place into a sea of red with the shirts we designed. And they're available, and we can't keep them on the shelves. They've been selling out as fast as they come in, unquote. He pointed out that under the previous administration, officers in Minneapolis were ordered to support their president, calling out local politicians. Now, that was when Obama was president. Not so much when the president is Donald J. Trump. But since 73,000 people have already signed up to try to attend, it looks like the president has a very strong following and will have a very successful campaign event on Thursday. Now, I think we have time for one more story. And this one came as a kind of surprise to me. I've been waiting for it, but I wasn't sure when to expect it. You know, we've been talking on and off about the whistleblower who reported an overheard conversation between President Trump and President Zelensky from Ukraine. But until today, we did not know who this person was. And it looked as though we might never find out. Because the head of the Congressional Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, made it very clear that he intended to protect the identity of the whistleblower. Nevertheless, that information is now out. And I want to share it with you because I think you have a right to know. When the President of the United States is attacked, he has the right to face his accuser, and the American people have the right to know who his accuser is. That's what I think. Because attacking the President is a very, very serious offense, particularly when it may lead to the impeachment of the President. And that's where this is leading. So for your information, it seems that the name of the whistleblower is Michael Barry. Now, I'm not the only one who has this information, but I may be one of the first to release it. And by the time you hear this, it may already be general knowledge. So who is Michael Barry? Michael Barry is a CIA agent, maybe not for very long, but as of today, he is an agent who was hired by General H.R. McMaster, who was the 26th United States National Security Advisor to President Donald Trump, and who remained in office until he was replaced in April 2018 by John Bolton. Now, we still don't know who the leaker was. We do know that Michael Barry did not have firsthand information about this telephone call. he was told about it by somebody else who was working in the White House and who overheard the conversation. So his identity is still unknown. Michael Barry is now being interrogated about his knowledge and about his contribution to the complaint that was filed about the president. I'm told that he's being considered a hostile witness, and I guess I can understand why. That's about as much as we know. We're waiting for more information, but at least the pertinent information about who the whistleblower was, we now have. And we'll learn more as the days go by. So stay tuned, and I will keep filling you in as the information comes in. Well, that's about all the time we have today. Thank you for spending this hour with me. It's always good to share with you some of the stories that have crossed my desk over the last week, and I hope to see you back again next week. You've been listening to the News Magazine on the America Out Loud Network. I'm Alana Friedman, and this has been the Friedman Report.